What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama has officially endorsed Hillary Clinton. Just 2 days after his former Secretary of State became the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee for president.
Look, I know how hard this job can be. That's why I know Hillary will be so good at it. In fact, I don't think there's ever been someone so qualified to hold this office.
The endorsement energizes Clinton's campaign as she turns her attention to presumptive Republican presidential candidate, her nominee, Donald Trump. The president's endorsement also is ending concerns about party unity after a long and intense battle between Clinton and Bernie Sanders. After meeting with the president on Thursday, Sanders addressed reporters outside the White House saying he has spoken to Clinton.
I congratulated her on her very strong campaign. I look forward to meeting with her in the near future to see how we can work together to defeat Donald Trump.
Sanders added that Trump would be a, quote, disaster of a president of the United States.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thousands of people, black and white, old and young, Muslims and Jews, packed Freedom Hall in Louisville, Kentucky, Thursday for a traditional Muslim funeral for Muhammad Ali. The boxing legend died last week at the age of 74 after a long fight against Parkinson's disease. Ali will be remembered again on Friday at a public interfaith memorial service in Louisville as well. You're listening to VOA News in Washington. Israel imposed travel restrictions Thursday on tens of thousands of Palestinians and sent hundreds of additional troops into the West Bank in response to a deadly shooting at a popular Tel Aviv tourist spot. But as the nation's leaders vowed tough responses, they stopped short of taking wider-scale military action. Israel's opposition leader, Isaac Herzog.
These were terrorists who came to kill citizens and frighten Israelis and try to break their life cycle. And that's why we are here in Sarona to show that life continues as usual and we will not give up and we will never be deterred by terror.
Four people were killed in the shooting, which was the deadliest and most brazen of attacks since violence erupted last September. When Pakistan's Council of Islamic Ideology proposed a law allowing men to beat their wives lightly, photographer Fahad Rajpur responded with a photo project called hashtag Try Beating Me Lightly. As VOA's Andrew Palcheski reports, the campaign not only went viral on social media, but sparked a global conversation about domestic violence.
It started with a proposal from Pakistan's Council of Islamic Ideology that would allow men to lightly beat their wives. Compelled by outrage over the proposal, Pakistani photographer Fahad Rajpur picked up his camera and started a photo campaign, capturing images of women telling the world what they would do if a man tried beating them lightly. Within a week, his hashtag Try Beating Me Lightly campaign went viral, sparking a global social media conversation about the treatment of women not only in Pakistan but around the world. Fahad told hashtag VOA via Skype from Pakistan he felt the campaign was his duty to shed light on domestic violence.
As a human, it's my duty to take a stand, and that's what I did.
Even though the campaign focuses on Pakistan, Cindy Dyer, vice president of human rights for women's advocacy organization Vital Voices, says that domestic violence is an issue that affects every country, including the United States.
Domestic violence is a global problem. It is the one problem that looks really, really the same no matter what country that you're in, including the United States.
Social media campaigns like hashtag Try Beating Me Lightly are raising awareness about an issue that has long remained in the shadows in many places around the world. Andrew Palcheski, VOA News, Washington.
A growing number of travelers are signing up for the government's expedited airport screening programs only to face another wait. After angry flyers missed flights this spring because of lengthy security lines, government officials promoted the pre-check and global entry systems. The number of applicants for pre-check more than tripled in a few months. But now there is a new logjam. It can take weeks or even months to get an appointment for an interview needed to complete the enrollment. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
We'll be right back.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's president defends why he prefers a Truth and Reconciliation Commission rather than a hybrid court.
The situation in South Sudan is very delicate. The people you would want to take to the court are still arms. And once they know that they are not protected, they are arms, they may cause havoc.
Aten Wek Aten is spokesman for President Salva Kiir of South Sudan. Liberia touts strengthened surveillance for being declared Ebola-free again. Ghanaian women are branching out into male-dominated industries. And Zambia's government denies President Edgar Lungu is ill.
It is not true. It's a malicious statement, and we are very disappointed that the Post newspaper, which is supposed to be the most credible newspaper with the most experienced reporters, is the one that is in the forefront spreading these malicious falsehoods.
Frank Bualia is deputy campaign manager for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party. Cape Verde wants to achieve 100% reliance on renewable energy. And boxers in Washington, D.C. remember the legacy of Muhammad Ali, who is being laid to rest today in his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir is defending an opinion piece published in the New York Times, which calls for a truth commission instead of trials for abuses committed during the country's recent civil war. But spokesman for former rebel leader and current first vice president Riek Machar, listed as the co-author of the opinion piece, says Machar did not write it and does not support the creation of a hybrid court. Jason Patinkin has more for VOA from Juba.
Earlier this week, the New York Times published an op-ed bylined South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and his rival-turned-first vice president, Riek Machar. In the article, they appeared to argue against creation of a proposed court, composed of both national and international elements, to try perpetrators of atrocities during the past 2.5 years of civil war. Kiir's spokesman, Aten Wek Aten, argues establishing a hybrid court would push the country back into violence.
The situation in South Sudan is very delicate. The people you would want to take to the court are still arms. And once they know that they are not protected, their arms, they may cause havoc.
But justice is a key demand of many South Sudanese people who survived the war. Rights activist Edmund Yakan said that op-ed is an attempt for war criminals in government to avoid justice. He said if there is no justice, abuses will continue.
That confirms to me how they, as a politicians, are using violence as an option of buying power. Because if they could believe that use of violence is not an option of buying power, they could have really promoted justice so that in future, others will never use violence as a way of buying power. But I think because now they have the power, so they feel there's no need for justice.
Feelings for justice are particularly strong among Machar's supporters, who say they were targeted by Kiir's troops. Juba University political science professor Jacob Chol said if Machar is against the hybrid court, his followers would abandon him.
So if you say that, look, I want to leave justice, they will say, look, then you're not a serious man. They will look at him as a liar and bad politician.
Machar deputy spokesman Nyarji Roman accused Kiir's side of submitting the story without the vice president's approval. Kiir's spokesman Aten admits the president and Machar did not write the op-ed, saying it came from his office with help from international public relations experts. But he insists Machar approved the article. Roman said the former rebel side, called the SPLM in opposition, will cooperate with any court process.
If there is enough evidence that can link any one of SPLM-IO members to any crimes against us like humanity, then we will hand them over to the court.
The New York Times has not responded to VOA's questions about how the article came to include Machar's name. Regardless, Professor Chol says the episode reveals problems of mistrust between Kiir and Machar, who joins in a unity government in April. Chol also says the fact the government stands by the op-ed shows they may fear an international court could succeed in prosecuting some of their members.
So there's a lot of worry from the government perspective that the court is going to take a lot of people in there.
For South Sudanese, the debate about justice for war crimes is far from over. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Juba.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu is said to be in good health and still campaigning for re-election ahead of the August 11 general election, despite local media reports that poor health has forced him to seek medical attention in neighboring South Africa. Frank Bualia, deputy campaign manager for the governing Patriotic Front Party, says reports of the president's poor health are a ploy by detractors to undermine Lungu's re-election efforts.
We are very shocked because President Lungu has been enjoying very, very good health. Nevertheless, we are not, in a certain sense, entirely surprised, as if by way of paradox, because the media house, the Post newspaper, which has published the same story today, has done it in a manner that clearly shows that their intention is not to report the truth, including about the health of the president, but to mislead the world and the Zambian public, that President Lungu should not be voted for because he's unwell, because he's sick. It is not true. It's a malicious statement, and we are very disappointed that the Post newspaper, which is supposed to be the most credible newspaper with the most experienced reporters, is the one that is in the forefront spreading these malicious falsehoods.
Father Bualia, on another note, the UPND, the main opposition party, has challenged President Edgar Lungu's asset declaration as not completely true. What is your response to that?
Yes, the UPND in this country has always used the strategy of projecting their own mistakes, their own inadequacies onto another political party or political leader as a way of diverting attention from their own mistakes, inadequacies, and corruption. And this leader, Mr. Agahinde Ichilema, is on record. So he publicly said he would not make the mistake of declaring all his assets, claiming that if he declared everything that he owned, government would pursue him. Now, that is totally illogical. If government wanted to pursue Mr. Agahinde Ichilema, they would pursue him on the basis of what he has declared. If he didn't acquire this wealth dubiously, why would he fear to declare everything that he owns?
The UPND has also stated that the current high poverty levels in the country is as a result of what the party describes as President Edgar Lungu's poor leadership qualities and inability to resolve challenges that Zambians face. Your response?
There is nowhere in the world where poverty was eradicated or poverty was drastic within 1 year, 4 months. So when they blame President Lungu for the poverty in the country, they decide to deliberately forget that the man has only been in office for 1 year, 4 months, somewhere there. How, even if he were a magician, would he reduce poverty in Zambia to levels that UPND says is acceptable? In fact, as far as we are concerned, there's no such a thing as acceptable levels of poverty.
Frank Bualia is the deputy campaign manager for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. Liberia is crediting strengthened surveillance and response capacity for again being declared free of active Ebola virus transmission by the World Health Organization. Liberia first declared itself Ebola-free in May last year, but the virus flared up again 3 times, most recently when a woman contracted the virus after traveling to neighboring Guinea and infecting her 2 children. Tolba Nyeswa, Liberia's Assistant Minister for Preventive Services, says being declared Ebola-free, even though this is the 4th time, proves Liberia can contain the virus.
Oh, it means that 42 days has come and gone after the last confirmed case was discharged from the ETU in Liberia, so there is no human-to-human transmission of active virus going on in the country.
Considering that this is, I think, about the 4th declaration since Ebola came to Liberia, what is Liberia going to do or is doing now to make sure it remains Ebola-free?
It demonstrates our capacity with active surveillance response capacity, building our laboratory system to detect, prevent, and respond to flare-ups of Ebola cases. And so we are doing surveillance and collecting information and responding adequately to not only Ebola, but other diseases of outbreak potentials that we call infectious diseases and disease of epidemic potentials.
So you are crediting Liberia's active surveillance for making possible this declaration?
Oh, yes, because we were able to quickly detect the 3 cases. We killed 2, the 7-year-old boy and the 2-year-old. Unfortunately, their mother died from the virus, but we were able to cure the two children, and we were able to carry on swift response and put this under control. So we again reached the 42-day mark of two incubation periods.
So the 90 days heightened surveillance you talk about, you think the Liberian people are ready or prepared for this? Because anything can happen during this time.
This is why we granularly go into the community level training, community-based event surveillance officers, training district surveillance officers, county surveillance officers, and they are on the watch. We integrating our disease surveillance and respond in all of our districts and communities across the country. So the health team is working with the communities, and communities are reporting events, including cross-border events.
Tolbin Yeswise, Liberia's Assistant Minister for Preventive Services. He was speaking with me from Ganta City, Central Liberia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 10th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Women in Ghana are branching out into traditionally male-dominated industries such as carpentry and taxi driving, and some of them are innovating along the way. Francesca Kekra Fosam has the story for VOA from Accra.
In Ghana today, women are rubbing shoulders with men at work, and not just in the corporate space. Esinam Nyado has gotten used to their looks.
I go like, why? It's because I'm a woman. And for me, in this sort of society, it's a no-go zone area for females to drive a taxi.
So, are you used to the stares now?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's one of three female taxi drivers in Accra. She calls herself Miss Taxi. She's also a wife, mother of two, and a student at the University of Ghana. Both the loan company and the taxi union rejected her at first.
They weren't sure I would even be able to make up sales or have a good business to pay back their car just because, you know, I'm a woman. And so they were like concerned about whether I wouldn't be open to car hijacking and they will end up losing their assets in the long term.
She now has a devoted clientele, many of them women, and she's innovating. She books her clients via social media, email, or text message, and she charges a flat hourly rate. She doesn't haggle like her male counterparts. In Ghana, people say men are better suited to jobs like construction, carpentry, and taxi driving. Those jobs require physical strength and danger. But men may not have the monopoly on toughness. Back in the 19th century, it was a woman, after all, who took the great Asante Empire to war with Ghana's British colonial masters. Ya Santua, to this day, is a celebrated queen mother of the modern-day Ashanti region. Salina Ajele Anan is a single mother who works as an electrician at Teshi.
And we work on extension boards, kettles, and many things.
She remembers the day she applied for a job.
They dismantled the fluorescent and they asked me to fix it. After I finish it, switch it on, and the bulb was on. Now they see that I'm serious.
She says salesmen have started referring clients. Like Miss Taxi, she has found that her gender is actually a draw.
They say, oh, we're a lady. They were surprised. They say, hey, I've never seen a woman electrician before, okay. But you surprise me. So anytime I get any problem, all my friends say they want, I'll call you, and I say, okay. They prefer me working for them than the men.
All her colleagues are men.
The first day she came here, what was it like for you? What did you think?
You know, it's not easy working with women. You know, because women, they always complain a whole lot.
Eric Ajete Otinkrang is one of her superiors. He says there are limits to what Anan can do. Francisca Kakra Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
Cape Verde has one of the most ambitious environmental goals in the world to achieve 100% reliance on renewable energy sources such as wind and solar. Although the previous government set a 2020 deadline on that goal, the current leadership has said it is aiming to achieve 100% reliance in the medium to long term. Jensenio Delgado, a renewable energy expert at the Cape Verde-based ECOWA Center for Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency, talks to Ricky Stryak about some of the challenges and accomplishments that the country has had so far in their mission.
The government of Cape Verde has established a very ambitious goal for renewable energy, which is to achieve 100% renewable energy penetration electricity production. In 2012, the country achieved about 25% of renewable energy penetration, and we are now about 30%.
And do you have a deadline for when you want to be 100%?
The first deadline was 2020, but now the government revised this deadline. There is no fixed deadline for 100%. The idea is this is the way that the country has, and depending on different aspects, we can achieve this in a medium long term.
And I know your organization, ECRI, works with both solar and wind. Is that correct? How much is Cabo Verde looking toward solar and how much are they looking toward wind?
Of course, also it will depend on the developments on the different technologies. What we have now is more wind energy than solar. But basically because of the initial cost of solar systems, but the technologies are evolving and it can be different in the future.
Can you tell me a little bit about what some of the challenges are to achieving this 100% renewable energy goal?
Normally, as you know, due to the variability of the renewable energy, there is technical challenges to go beyond certain level of renewable energy penetration. I would say 30 are bigger when systems are smaller, like in Cape Verde, we have inhabited islands, very small electrical systems.
That was Jensenio Delgado, a renewable energy expert, speaking to Ricky Stryak from Praia, Cape Verde. Thousands of people, black and white, Muslims and Jews, old and young, packed Freedom Hall in Louisville, Kentucky yesterday, Thursday, for a traditional Muslim funeral for Muhammad Ali. The boxing legend, who was known by billions around the world, died last week at age 74 after a long fight against Parkinson's disease. A public memorial service will be held today where dignitaries from around the world will pay tribute, will pay their respects. Viewer's Deborah Block went to a boxing gym in Washington, D.C., where some fighters talked about Ali's legacy.
These top amateur and professional boxers sparring at the Washington, D.C. Department of Recreation's Headbangers Gym were not even born when Muhammad Ali was in his prime and winning major heavyweight competitions. But Patrick Harris, who grew up in a boxing family and knew of Ali's triumphs early on, says Ali's influence on his career is undeniable.
I have confidence in what I do, you know. Just, you know, had that mentality that nobody can beat me.
Anthony Peterson says Ali showed him how to be strong.
Never be afraid of your opponent and have fun.
Kazakh fighter Chingizhan Tajibai came to the gym 3 years ago to continue his boxing career in the United States. One of Ali's most famous quotes made an impression on him.
I like his leg moves, like a fly, like a butterfly in the thing, like a bean, you know. That was one of the lessons which I learned.
Raynell Williams thinks Ali's accomplishments were felt around the world.
Because he'd go to these different countries and had these big fights.
Head trainer Barry Hunter appreciates that Ali took boxing to a whole new level and made it into what it is today.
Changed boxing forever. He brought the big dollars to boxing. He brought all the star power to boxing. He brought the style to boxing.
Hunter also admires Ali for standing up for his beliefs, especially black pride and defying racial oppression. Police officer Tiara Brown, who won an Olympic gold medal in boxing in 2012, calls Ali inspirational.
He was a civil rights activist, and he was a great athlete. He motivates us to be all that we can be.
18-year-old Duke Reagan says his dad always talked about Ali and said the young Duke reminded him of the great fighter.
And he always said that my dad was strong in my left hand, so he always said that I was going to be another Muhammad Ali, just a shorter version.
Keithlin King from the Caribbean country of St. Vincent and the Grenadines says what he respects most about Ali is that he was a good man.
So I try to live something like Muhammad Ali. I try to be good to everybody. That's one thing I love about Muhammad Ali. He was a great, great, great person.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenyan Asbel Kiprop clocked 3 minutes and 51.48 seconds to triumph in the 1 mile at the IWF Diamond League in Oslo, Norway on Thursday. Such was the pace in the race that Kenyan runner-up Elijah Manangoi posted a personal best of 3 minutes and 52.04 seconds ahead of Algerian Olympic 1500-meter champion Taufik Makloufi. Kenya's Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon prevailed in the women's 1 mile in 4 minutes and 18.6 seconds. Meanwhile, Hagos Gebrehiwet clocked 13 minutes and 7.70 seconds to lead Edris Mukhtar and Yomif Kejelcha in a 1-2-3 Ethiopian medal podium sweep in men's 5,000 meters. Kenyan Hyvin Kiyeng was victorious in women's 3,000 meters steeplechase in 9 minutes and 9.57 seconds. Ethiopians Sofia Asefa and Etenesh Diro placed second and third, respectively. Turning to football, Egypt host Rwanda in the return leg of the Africa Under-20 Championship qualifier in Cairo today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, South Africa play Namibia, Gabon encounter Angola, Senegal face Tunisia, as defending champions Nigeria are at home to Burundi in Calabar, Cross River State, South-South Nigeria. On Sunday, Ghana host Ethiopia, Republic of Congo engage Burkina Faso, Cameroon encounter Zimbabwe, Lesotho challenge Mozambique, Mali engage Mauritania, Guinea host Ivory Coast, and Morocco play Gambia. In Namibia, Zimbabwe engage Swaziland at the start of the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in the capital Windhoek tomorrow, Saturday. Seychelles will play Madagascar in the other Group A encounter. On Sunday in Group B action, Lesotho face Mauritius and Malawi challenge Angola. Finally, Benin host Equatorial Guinea in the Orange African Cup of Nations qualifier in Cotonou that was postponed to Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. Here's our listener mail for this Friday morning, June 10th.
May I use this opportunity to congratulate Mrs. Hillary Clinton for her presidential nominee. Dear Madam, Africa is proud of you and also wish you a very successful victory into the presidential seat. I am Prince John Shea from Obanigo in Obudukate Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria. Thank you, VOA.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. And that is it for this Friday, June 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk, dual citizenship. Would you consider acquiring the citizenship of another country? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing dual citizenship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we will discuss African Liberation Day. Tune into Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC to join host Shaka Saleh and his panels of guests.